Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're talking to the sex doctor, Dr. Madeline Castellano. She's in private practice here in Manhattan. She's also the author of a book called Wanting to Want. You can find that title on Amazon. It's an ebook, but soon to be published in paperback form. And a question came up. Actually, I posed this in part one of our podcast, which you can go back and review, about the effects, the pervasive effects of pornography on our view of sexuality. It seems that, you know, through advertising and through the ever-present access to pornography, even for very young people, we're being exposed to images of sexuality that maybe illusory, that maybe, or do you think pornography is messing things up, or is it just a superior form of sex education for the young?
Well, Ron, thanks again for having me on your program. As far as pornography goes, I just want to make sure and mention that I'm not anti-porn. I think that pornography can be a very erotic addition for people in their individual exploration of what's erotic for them, as well as for a couple, if they choose to have that as a shared experience. But pornography is a fantasy. Pornography is an unreal, made-up situation with actors and somewhat semblance of a script that goes through and shows acts of sex. And it really plays on the most fantastic pieces, bits and pieces of fantasy in order to get a response. It's meant to be very, very stimulating, let's put it that way. But the acts that it portrays are not the realistic act of sex. And so what that does is, if that's the only exposure you have to learning about sex as you're growing up, you tend to think that maybe that's how sex is supposed to go.
Right, that every bout of sex is extremely athletic, that it goes on for about 23 minutes and culminates in multiple orgasms for the woman.
Right. Well, even more damaging is the expectation that a woman will be instantly turned on just by touching her a certain way, or that she's going to be lubricated right away, that she's going to be extremely vocal, that she's going to, as you said, have multiple orgasms with seemingly no effort. And what this does is creates a very unrealistic...
It's a high bar to achieve,
well,
and
it's sad because there's women out there that literally are thinking, wow, first of all, I don't look like these women, so there's a strike against me. I don't really feel naturally like acting like that, so there must be something wrong with me because I don't get aroused like they do, and I certainly don't respond like they do, so what's wrong with me? And men also are, this is the only source of education about sex, are also wondering, well, first of all, how come I'm not looking like those guys, right? Why don't I get aroused immediately like they do? How come sometimes I might lose my erection if I'm going on for a long time or giving my partner some other form of stimulation that isn't penetration, when these other guys seem to keep their erection no matter what? And how come it's so difficult for me to give my partner an orgasm by just having penetration? So
yeah.
There's a lot to be said about porn as far as it creating unrealistic expectations. And if you follow those, then you're going to be unhappy about what's going on in your sex life because it's just not going to match up. And it's not supposed to match up.
Yeah, so if you're going to watch porn, you know, with a sense of detachment. You know, it might... a little bit like I might watch Aaron Rodgers throw the football for Green Bay. I mean, I'm not going to throw the football that way, but I enjoy watching him anyway.
Right, exactly. I mean, think about it as far as, like, the fantasy, right? Like, every other movie that you see out there, the Transformers, you know, James Bond, the Fast and the Furious, like, most of us are not living those lives in that sort of crazy, exaggerated way because it's a fantasy, and that's okay.
Right. So give us a sense of, actually, in the book you include some very nice examples, but give us an example of a typical interaction that you might have with the patient. First a female, and then a male. By the way, what percentage of your clients or patients are females, and what percentage are males?
Well, it's interesting. It seems to change and there's waves. Right now, I tend to have a lot of couples and a lot of men, single men. Mm-hmm. But in the past, I've had a lot more single women and couples. So right now, I would say it's probably about 45% couples and 55% men. No, that's not true. I would say I do have a few single female right now.
Well, is it important for a couple to embark on this together? I mean, because it's kind of like, well, what if a man is having sexual problems and the woman says to the man, look, you got to get fixed. You got to go to the doctor, do something, because I will not put up with this. And is that an unhelpful way to get the problem worked out?
Well, whatever gets them started in sex therapy is great. However, you're right. They are going to have so much more success if they end up coming in together.
If there's buy-in from both partners.
Absolutely, because not only does a difficulty, let's say it did start off as an individual difficulty, maybe one partner had anxiety, soon after that starts, it's going to get worked into the dynamic of the relationship. And so that means that you're going to have both parties there to help unwind how that dynamic has affected their sex life. And what we say is that the problem, it's not just a problem of one individual, it's now the relationship's problem. And so I will start off sometimes having just an individual session to hear what's going on, and sometimes I'll do a lot of individual work with one or both partners in a couple. But eventually, to have really good resolution, you need the couple working together. So it's so helpful. I always try to make sure that if one person's coming in, I say, well, did you tell your partner you're coming for sex therapy? And are they willing to come with you for sex therapy? Because that makes a big difference.
Is failure sometimes an option? Because perhaps in dealing with an issue of sexual incompatibility, other issues of incompatibility can come to the fore. And perhaps, you know, a couple may say, hey, we've got deeper problems than just our ability to engage in sex.
There are couples that have tried to explore what's going on with their sex life, and then they find that their anger or resentment or other issues are so deep that those either need to be addressed first or can't possibly be addressed because either they don't want to put forth the effort or it's just too painful for them. And so, yeah, failure is an option, of course. And some people find that what their expectations for what their sex life would be change as they're doing therapy, and they recognize, hey, maybe our sex life can be different but still wonderful. And that's another option.
Right. Well, okay, so coming back to the examples, you know, typically, what are women saying to you?
So typically, I would say women have difficulty either having sex or reaching orgasm. And both of those are usually due to high levels of anxiety.
So one is the syndrome of, like, women saying, look, honey, I've got a headache, or just really not looking forward to it, or, you know, maybe putting up with it but not enjoying it. And the other is they'd like to have sex, they'd like to have intimacy, but they can't get to that plateau of arousal and orgasm.
Well, certainly for the women that come to see me that can't have sex, there are women that have problems with desire. There are also women that have difficulty just having penetration. So what they're having is an unconscious spasm of the pelvic floor muscles in response to their anxiety, which actually keeps them from having penetration. So those are the women that can't even go get an exam at the gynecologist.
Uh-huh, right. There's no spatula small enough or, you know, whatever.
Right, because it's just that uncomfortable.
And there's actually a term for this? And I'm going to surprise you that I know it. It's vaginismus. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm not a sex therapist, but that's a medical term,
yeah.
Which is an interesting word, which refers to this phenomenon, which is actually not exceedingly rare.
Right, exactly. But it's very amenable to treatment. So if women out there are listening to this and they're having difficulty, please look for a provider that will help you with vaginismus, because it is very, very treatable.
And it's actually, the treatment is actually a form of physical therapy. It's a form of relaxation for the pelvic muscles, and it's something that can be done by people who sometimes also treat disorders of urinary incontinence. It's urogenital therapy of some kind.
I always tell women, and I tell gynecologists and urologists too, that the best treatment for vaginismus is a two-pronged approach. One is the physical part of it, so either, you know, dilator therapy and or physical therapy that goes along with that.
Perhaps even, you know, estrogen hormone therapy if there's an issue of vaginal atrophy or dryness, postmenopause, right. That kind of thing.
Correct. Or post-cancer treatment.
Yep.
But also to have the psychological aspect, because especially for women who are not in menopause or don't have a pain syndrome, but they're having vaginismus, they must attend to the psychological factors fueling that anxiety in order for it to resolve completely and for them to really have good pleasure. So the dilator by itself is one part of the treatment. They should have the therapy part as well.
Right, because for the psychological aspects of it.
Right.
And, okay, so the approach to the woman who comes to you might include what?
So I'm going to be exploring with her own ideas about sex. Like, how did she learn about sex? And what did she learn about sex? Did she learn that sex probably was going to be painful the first time, and so therefore she's, you know, unable to consummate or lose her virginity because she's petrified of what that's going to feel like? Was she told that, you know, her parts are dirty? Was she told that to think about and desire sex is not modest and improper for a woman, and so therefore she's continuously racked by guilt whenever she does have feelings of desire for her partner? So I want to explore all of those things and the psychological basis for how she views sexuality. Then I also want to look at any biological reasons, of course. I have to ask her hormone status and do a little questioning to find out what's going on with, you know, the rest of her. Is she sleeping? Is her skin changing? You know, is she tired all the time? Is she having difficulty losing weight? So what are those things that might clue me into some hormonal issues that I might have to address? Knowing, of course, we have to deal with adrenals first, then thyroid, then the sex hormone.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next aspect would be, hey, how's her relationship? What factors in the relationship might be discouraging her from having pleasure or relaxing into sexual activity? Does she feel pressured? Does she feel humiliated? Does she feel responsible? So all of these things are going to affect how she's going to approach sex.
Is there such a thing, we're sort of in a technological space race between men and women to achieve sexual satisfaction. Men, so far, the score is, it's 14 to nothing. You know, men are 2 touchdowns ahead because they've got Viagra, they've got Cialis, they've got Levitra.
Yeah.
And so far, the equivalent medication or treatment hasn't been developed for women. Is there such a thing as a female Viagra, something that, approximates the benefits of Viagra for women?
You know, the interesting thing about Viagra, and to answer your question, is that even for men, sometimes Viagra doesn't do everything because it only takes
sure.
care of the erectile tissue.
Yeah.
So for women, Viagra actually does help to engorge their erectile tissue, but that's not really what gets them to want to have sex. So I think that the search for medications that might help women in sexual desire, just as how hormones are important and for us to have good, you know, bioidentical formulations of hormones are important to have for women as choices, those are good things to look for. I'm not sure that one particular medication is going to cover all the bases.
Right. There are actually some drugs on the launch pad because this is this could be a huge market. As you say, this is such a prevalent problem, and maybe we're talking about a market of 40, 50 million American women alone who might reach for such a pill if it were to be available. And there are actually a couple that are being still in investigational stage that are said to enhance libido and sexual response. And I'm not just talking about testosterone, because testosterone, you know, depends on which study you look at, may or may not enhance women's libido and sexual response.
Right. Well, you know, what I say about testosterone is that it's going to increase your energy and your motivation to do whatever it is that you already like to do. So if you didn't like sex or you had difficulty with sex before your testosterone levels were low, and of course we're assuming that if testosterone is helping you, it's because your levels were that low to begin with, it's not necessarily going to make you want to have sex. It might make you want to go out and get a second job or start an exercise program.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily 100% of the time mean that you're going to want to have more sex.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, if that's the problem, then it really is helpful to have that extra energy and motivation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to take care of all the bases.
What about other over-the-counter natural interventions? I've heard it said that maca is beneficial for
maca,
some women.
Very interesting. Maca tends to increase your libido, and it doesn't have any negative effects on your hormone levels, which is very nice. Because
right.
Some of the problems of taking exogenous hormones, so that's hormones from outside your body, right, not producing them from inside, is that if your brain says, whoa, this is way too much hormone, I thought I only wanted it, you know, at this level, and now I have all this extra, it's going to stop producing its own.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take something like maca, it doesn't negatively interfere with your own body's hormone production, which is very nice. So maca's a good one. I think that optimizing the diet is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have to have zinc in your diet to have good testosterone production. And we also know that L-arginine helps with blood flow in your arteries.
Right.
If you have damage in your arteries from things like smoking or high blood pressure, hopefully you're going to correct, you know, take away the cigarette smoking and improve your blood pressure. But the L-arginine can actually help
right.
repair the inside of those blood vessels. So not just good for your erection and for women for lubrication and stimulation, but also good for your heart.
Yeah, I'm actually doing a little preliminary research for my chapter in the book, Integrative Integrative Sexual Health. And one of the things that has come up, and this is actually in line with one of my sponsors on my radio program, they make a product called Super Beets, which is a source of dietary nitrates, which is a precursor to nitric oxide, and that's the you know Viagra connection, and may help circulation. Again, not a magic pill for sexual performance, but something that may gently support sexual performance because it improves circulation, as you said. What about DHEA? DHEA, I've found in some of my female patients, does give them a little bit of a twinkle in the eye.
Well, absolutely, and DHEA can be converted in your system as well. So DHEA for some women is wonderful. Sometimes they will use it in a compounded vaginal cream, and sometimes you can just take it orally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important, especially if you're thinking about, does this person have adrenal fatigue? You know, have they been at that very, very high stress level for years and years and years? You know, you test their cortisol and their DHEA, and you find, wow, they really need some replacement. So yes, absolutely. That's one of the things that I would think about if you're going to be looking at the entire hormone picture for men and for women.
What about your typical man coming in with sexual problems? Is it mostly about ED or other problems loom?
For the most part, I would say the majority of men that I see is for erectile dysfunction, although I have seen several as well for low sexual desire. But usually what they're having is difficulty with anxiety and being disconnected that's causing their erectile dysfunction.
So that could apply to very young men who have a full complement of testosterone or otherwise very healthy, have great circulation, they don't have diabetes, they don't have heart disease, but they simply have issues with sexual performance.
Right. It could either be that they're living a really unhealthy lifestyle. Like if you're out there and you are drinking regularly,
mm-hmm.
or you're binge drinking, you have to know that you're converting your testosterone to estrogen. You're lowering your levels of testosterone and you're boosting your levels of cortisol. Not good for your sexual performance.
Hmm.
That needs to be said. It also interferes with you being able to get good sleep. It doesn't allow you to go into the deep stages of sleep the way you're supposed to, which is very regenerative for your adrenal functioning and very important for your testosterone production.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a young guy, you have to be exercising, you have to be cutting down drinking, and you have to be sleeping if you want your body to work the way it's supposed to. And then anxiety. Anxiety triggers your fight-or-flight response, and that literally short-circuits your arousal process. Now, some people are more sensitive to this than others, and for those guys that are sensitive, I mean, sometimes even just even drinking too much caffeine can be a problem. But certainly, all the thoughts that they have, oh, am I going to get an erection? Oh, am I going to be able to keep the erection? Is this going to work? Is she going to be happy? I'm not really happy with what I'm doing. All of those things continuously trigger anxiety, and they keep you actually from being where you need to be in that erotic space with your partner, because if you're focused on anxiety, your brain can only think about one thing at a time. So it can't possibly be having sexy erotic mm-hmm. thoughts if you're having these anxious, you know, right. performance anxiety thoughts.
Right. It's like a valve, you know, if anxiety is flowing through it, it's just not going to work in the other way.
Right.
You know, so
and you're getting this release of adrenaline each time you have a negative, you know, thought or an anxious thought, and it takes about a minute and a half to metabolize that adrenaline. And so if you keep triggering those thoughts over and over and over again, it becomes so difficult to relax
yeah.
into arousal.
Unfortunately, many of the pharmacological fixes for anxiety, you know, like the SSRI drugs, which really help to calm people down, have a negative effect on libido, especially for women. Do you see a lot of women who, you know, since I read a statistic where 25% of women are now taking some form of antidepressant medication, is that putting a damper on their sexual response?
Absolutely, and in a very, very significant way. So not just women, men too. And it's because for some people it can interfere with the arousal process, and for others it can interfere with reaching orgasm
mm-hmm.
because the antidepressants, specifically the serotonin reuptake inhibitors,
Paxil, Zoloft, Prozac,
Lexapro, right, all of those, they will, because they increase serotonin, they happen to dampen the effect on dopamine, and so that is going to interfere with arousal. So that's a big problem, and actually how I really kind of got into doing sex therapy, because early in my residency years, I found so many people were having all of these sexual complaints, and I thought, well, how are we going to help them with it? So one of the things I really do want to find out in my patients is, have you really had a significant depressive episode or significant anxiety, and can we work on that in another way so we can either decrease the medication, or do you need to be on that medication to begin with, really? And now, for some people, they have. You know, there's people that are hospitalized for significant depression, and or some people with significant anxiety that can't even function. And then definitely I would say, hey, we have to find...
The medication may take precedence, but for right. people who are suffering from ordinary run-of-the-mill mild dysphoria, the blues, preferably avoid the medication and use more natural approaches. What are some of the natural approaches to depression and anxiety that you might use?
Well, one of the things that I use very commonly is what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, and I work with clients to identify what negative thoughts and thought patterns that they have that are interfering with them really looking at a situation realistically. So remember before I mentioned how a man might have some of these thoughts go through his mind when he's having an interaction, like, wow, am I even going to be able to get an erection? Or is she going to like what I'm doing? Or is it going to be able to last? Or how hard is my erection right now? We work with those thoughts so that they can quickly, I guess, put them aside and have more positive thoughts,
mm-hmm.
a more positive reframing that helps them get back to the erotic situation. Because when their mind's flooded with those thoughts, they can't do anything. And the example I like to give my clients is, I say, imagine that you're taking care of a child, and all day long you're telling them, you're not doing that right. You don't know anything. How can you be so stupid? It's not going to work. You're never going to be able to do it. Right? And I say, imagine the look on that child's face. And imagine, after a day of giving them all of these comments, what that child feels like. Right? So that is what you're doing to your own mind if you're giving yourself this cascade of negative thoughts constantly over and over and over mm-hmm. again. It doesn't engender any positive motivation at all.
Right.
And so I teach them how to have a different thought process that works to their benefit, so that they can eliminate all of this negativity that's just bringing them down.
Well, that's very powerful, and I think that's highly transformative, and that's, of course, what we want to do in the field of sexuality, as with many aspects of life, and that's what you're doing. The book is Wanting to Want, and you can get it on Amazon. It's an ebook now. It'll be out in paperback because I don't know, it's probably easier to hold a paperback book in your hand and read it while you're having sex than holding an iPad or something, right? That's probably why you did it, right?
No. So, no, don't read it while you're having sex.
Okay.
Be completely, 100% in the moment. You could read it before or after.
Okay.
Share it with your partner, definitely.
I thought it was like that. What was that book that was so popular that had all the sexual positions in it that when we were younger? What was it?
Joy of Sex.
The Joy of Sex. It was like, you know, like a handbook. It was like instruction manual.
Great. You know what? That's a wonderful, wonderful book with beautiful illustrations. And it's such a positive, you know, presentation of that, of the sexual connection. So I think The Joy of Sex is a wonderful book.
Indeed. So... our call to action for Intelligent Medicine today is get the book Wanting to Want. If you're a patient in need of some advice on the sexual front, Dr. Madeline Castellano is in private practice in New York. What's your website?
My website is thesexmd.com.
All right. That's easy to remember. And probably trademarked as well, right?
Yes, it is. Thank
Good.
You.
Okay. So... thank you very much for joining us, and you know, and thank you for taking on this very, very important aspect of human health. We tend to be squeamish talking about it, but it's a very, very important part of our discussion when we talk about the whole perspective on intelligent medicine. This is part and parcel of it.
Yeah, Ron, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and honor to be able to discuss that here with you.
Well, thank you very much, Madeline. Really enjoy having you as a colleague and a resource here in New York City. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.